This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
National news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Groundwire. Community news from coast to coast to coast. Today on Groundwire.
So there's a lot of people doing direct action work, and this gathering was designed to bring together the people doing direct action.
There are some anti-racist tournaments in Italy with FIFA as a sponsor, but our model is another kind of tournament.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Jeanne Zami. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This week, Groundwire is produced on traditional Mohawk territory at CKUT in Montreal. Coming up, an anti-racist soccer tournament in Montreal and an innovative grassroots initiative to reduce business greenhouse gas emissions in Kingston, Ontario, as well as a community radio report celebrating the 28th anniversary of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. But first, here are the headlines. On July 11th, the Supreme Court of Canada rendered its decision of the Key Wadden versus the Ministry of Natural Resources case, in which the Ojibwe community of Grassy Narrows was fighting the Ontario provincial government to protect their hunting and trapping rights on Treaty 3 territory. In a 7-0 decision, the Supreme Court upheld the Ontario government's right to grant industrial logging permits on Grassy Narrows' traditional territory. This defeat comes 14 years after the Indigenous community initially took up the legal battle against Ontario. Grassy Narrows is also the home of the longest Indigenous blockade against clear-cutting, which began in 2002. Here is Chief Robert Fobister speaking on CKUT's Off the Hour program, explaining the community's problems with clear-cutting.
There's clear cuts on our Aboriginal land, which affected our trap lane and our animal populations on our Aboriginal land. Mm-hmm. So it was really affecting our treaty rights to hunt, fish, and trap on our Aboriginal territory. Like, how could we, you know, continue with our traditional lifestyles, you know, when the lands are clear cut by logging.
On July 11th in Montreal, nearly 1,000 people attended a Palestine solidarity rally to protest Israeli attacks on the illegally occupied Gaza Strip and to call for more participation in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, or BDS. The government of Israel said the recent attacks are a defense against rocket fire from the governing Hamas party. Hamas, in return, says it is firing on Israel in defense of local citizens. By Groundwire production time, more than 550 Palestinians have been killed, the vast majority of them civilians, as well as 18 Israeli soldiers and one Israeli civilian. Here is CKUT's Under the Olive Tree reporting live from the rally in Montreal.
As chanting filled the streets, protesters stopped in front of the bookstore Chapters Indigo to denounce its support of the Israeli military and to call for its boycott. Ihab Lotoyev from the Gaza Ark Project explained to us why protesters are calling for the boycott of Chapters Indigo.
The businesses and the governments that support Israel are what give it the opportunity to do what it's doing and to commit the massacres it's committing. BDS is boycott disinvestment and sanctions. It's a call, like the call that happened against the apartheid regime in South Africa, to boycott and not invest in and apply sanctions to the Zionist regime in Israel as long as it abuses the Palestinian people and takes away their rights. Indigo business is owned by Heather Reisman and her husband, who have established a foundation to pay for the Israeli soldiers who volunteer in the Israeli army from foreign countries. So they are a direct bloodline to the Israeli army and have a big role to play in what the Israeli army does to the Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and Gaza.
For information about other upcoming Gaza Solidarity rallies across Canada, visit canadianpeace.org gaza-solidarity. This next headline comes from Catherine Fisher at CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
The BC Environmental Assessment Office has given the green light to a large ski resort city proposed for southeastern British Columbia. Glacier Resorts Limited have been permitted to self-report on their compliance with 195 conditions to be met before the company may construct Jumbo Resort, which is located on and around Jumbo Glacier in the Purcell Mountain Range. Many locals oppose the construction of the resort, which is expected to span 6,000 hectares and feature 23 ski lifts and accommodation and amenities for more than 6,000 people. The Senext First Nation, the Tanaha First Nation, and environmental groups also oppose the project due to its probable impact on grizzly bears and other animal populations. The company states in their self-report on compliance with conditions that they will mitigate these possible consequences, but Kaylin DeKeevy of West Kootenay Coalition for Jumbo Wild says,
"There is no mitigating for the damage that a 6,000-bed ski city would cause to the grizzly bear population. This area is a core source of sustenance for grizzly bears in this region. In fact, the United States are trying to lure grizzly bears back into their territory from this source population. There are parcels of land being bought up to facilitate the movement of bears to expand their territory back into the U.S. from the Purcells."
Robin Duncan of the East Kootenay Environmental Organization WildSite objects that approval for construction has been granted based on Glacier Resort's own self-report on compliance with legally binding conditions, believing that the company's compliance should be verified by a third party. Glacier Resorts Limited expects to begin construction at Jumbo this summer.
That's all for headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. And now for our feature stories. 8 months after a flare-up between Indigenous activists in Elsig-Pogtog, New Brunswick, and natural gas company SWN Resources, preparation for shale gas extraction moves forward. And so do organizing efforts to stop it. Here's a report from CHMA-FM's Michael Freeman and Heidi Griffin in Sackville, New Brunswick, on current efforts by Indigenous and environmental groups to form a common strategy to defend water in New Brunswick.
On Saturday, July 5th, some 50 activists and community members gathered at the Copit Lodge in Elsabuktuk, a Mi'kmaq community in New Brunswick that gained national recognition on October 17, 2013, when Mi'kmaq warriors and activist allies set up barricades to block SWN Resources from beginning 2D seismic imaging, the first step in shale gas extraction. CHMA's correspondent Heidi Dawn Griffin spoke with Curtis White, the facilitator of the Unity Gathering.
I was asked to help coordinate things, help planning, because we don't want the same thing to happen on October 17th of last year to happen again. So to do that, you've got to be smart. You have to plan. You have to organize. You have to find allies. And one of the things that we decided to meet as a community, and we came up with a vision. And the vision is quite simply and profound: protect the water. From that, we said, well, we need a place to meet. And we came up with the Copit Lodge. So now it's a viable place where people can come, stay, have something to eat, but more importantly, meet and talk about some of these issues. And out of that has been a whole series of other meetings that we've had with other groups like this today, where we got together to talk about protecting the water. Without safe, clean drinking water, we will perish. We will disappear. So to prevent that, we have to organize, plan, and say no. You will not take this right of free, clean drinking water from us, that we're going to fight to hang on to it.
White went on to talk about the importance of the Unity Gathering as a forum for groups with diverse approaches and tactics to form a common vision and shift from talk to action.
The vision was the same of protecting the water. Ways of going about it were sometimes a little bit different, but everyone, I think, agreed to today that talk is important, planning is important, but action is more important. So we're moving into a phase of action now, where people who are listening to this can participate and get involved, because if it can happen to Penobscot, where the land is being poisoned, the air is being poisoned by the flares. If it can happen in northern Alberta with the tar sands, it's coming to an area near you. It's time that people say enough is enough, and that the fundamental right of fresh, clean, free drinking water is stood up for. Otherwise, two things will happen. One, you'll perish because you don't have water. Two, you'll become a slave to whoever is feeding you the water.
A number of high-profile direct actions surrounded the event and were centered on asserting claims to land. Mi'kmaq activists planted signs in a protected marshland area within the purview of SWN Resources' seismic imaging territory that said, quote, Mi'kmaq people reclaim the stewardship of Sigatog territory due to misuse of land held in trust by the Crown. Correspondent Heidi Dawn Griffin was on the scene and joined us in the studio to report on what she saw at the Unity Gathering. According to her, the most important and effective part of the gathering was the building of relationships among groups with diverse orientations.
So there's a lot of people doing direct action work, and this gathering was designed to bring together the people doing direct action with the multiple organizations and individuals from around the province and the Maritimes who are supporting them. The event was basically three large sharing circles, and everyone in the circle respected different points of view, and there were different points of view. There were a vast amount of, you know, older activists who were really talking about different ways to engage the government, and the more youthful people who often find direct action to be the most successful way to oppose things.
In the first circle, every participant introduced themselves. In the second circle, participants highlighted actions that they have been working on in their own communities in defense of water. After the second circle, participants paused to share a meal. Griffin noted that the relationship building that happened during the meal was a core element of the organizing that happened at the Unity Gathering. The third circle was about planning ahead and determining future orientations for organizing around shale gas extraction in New Brunswick.
And then we came back to the large circle and proposed different ways that we could build towards the future and bring all of our different skills to the table.
Concrete actions that came out of the strategizing included surveying popular opinion, using lawn sign campaigns to increase the visibility of opposition to shale gas extraction, gathering more frequently to share ideas between groups, and using spaces such as the Copit Lodge, which has become a center for exchange of ideas about actions to defend water rights. For CHMA in Sackville, New Brunswick, I'm Michael Freeman.
Nonprofit organizations, Sustainable Kingston, and Hearthmakers Energy Cooperatives are collaborating to encourage emissions reductions from local businesses. Brenna Owen from Alternative Frequency on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston spoke to Katie Wall and Brooke Gilmore, who are collaborating to spearhead the project.
So I'm Katie Wall, and I'm the Project and Outreach Coordinator for Sustainable Kingston.
I am Brooke Gilmore, and I am the Executive Director of Hearthmakers Energy Cooperative, which is a local not-for-profit that focuses on energy and water conservation initiatives.
Sustainable Kingston is a nonprofit, community-driven organization. We work towards promoting sustainability in the community based on the Sustainable Kingston Plan that was developed with the City of Kingston and input from citizens from Kingston. So the project that we're sort of trying to put together is based very similarly to the regional or Sustainable Waterloo Region's Regional Carbon Initiative. And that's a program sort of targeted towards workplaces to help them reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And they've had a lot of success with their program, the Regional Carbon Initiative. And based on that success, the founder of that program has gone on to make what's now known as Sustainability CoLab, which is a provincial network of communities now that are all sort of using the lessons learned from Sustainable Waterloo Region to make a very similar program in their own communities. But it is catered towards their own communities. So what Kingston puts together will probably be a little bit different than what Waterloo puts together based on the different business profiles in the community and different community needs.
Why do you think it's so important to target specifically businesses in Kingston?
Well, businesses in general, I'll reference the climate action plan that was just released by the City of Kingston. our local greenhouse gas emissions, the total emissions from the ICI sector or workplace sector. So ICI is institutional, commercial, and industrial. So and that it does include mom and pops to large businesses. That is 51% of our local region's emissions. And typically, that's been a market that has not been specifically targeted to educate and to help them reduce their emissions. And we can see that by the breakout. 17% is our residential. So our residential typically has been, you know, more targeted from different federal initiatives to provincial initiatives to reduce their emissions. So this is a sector that we definitely see a need in helping Kingston meet their greenhouse gas reduction targets by 2020.
Do you think there's also some resistance in the business community as compared to perhaps a resident looking to retrofit their home?
I don't necessarily think there's a resistance, but I think there's a disconnect. There's a disconnection. You know, we did a poll at the community forum of how many people on a residential level monitor their utility bills and on a monthly basis. And everyone put up their hand. However, from a business perspective, only one business put up their hand that they monitor their electrical, gas, whatever fuel consumptions that they have on a monthly basis. So it's either, I think it's a limitation in time, and especially when you have smaller businesses, that's it. It's an added step in your monthly duties that you have to do. So I just think it's an intangible or a challenge to them at this point in time. So making it easy for them to overcome that challenge is, I think, our key step. I don't know if it's helping them overcome it, not necessarily them resisting wanting to do something.
So what are some of those ways that you are going to help them overcome?
Well, hopefully through this project, we'll be sort of working with them and showing them the benefits of tracking their greenhouse gas emissions. So you made a good point there, Brooke, is that people in their residences do look at their bills, but there might be a bigger organization where the person who's maybe got these programs going on maybe doesn't even pay the bill or see the bill. So I think that'll be a really important aspect, is just making sure that sort of tracking is happening. And once you see, I mean, even in your residence at home when you're paying the bill and you see how big that bill is, you're thinking, okay, what can I unplug, right? So it's kind of along the same mentality as hopefully if we can get people tracking and seeing their emissions and the money that they're spending on it, hopefully inspiring them, motivating them to look for ways to reduce their emissions, mm-hmm. their impact.
And I think it's about empowering too. I think it's that empowering the employees, not just the business owner, to understand the benefits and, you know, having, you know, one topic or one word that we have been throwing around is like, you know, having businesses have green teams or, you know, that green leader, somebody to take on that challenge to, you know, to just be thinking about that all the time. Just taking that down to like the grassroots level of employee empowerment, mm-hmm. as well.
And also providing mentorship and coaching. You know, you can sort of get a lot of organizations on board, and just like you might make New Year's resolutions, they kind of fade off over time. But if you kind of have, hopefully us or an external organization or someone to just keep reminding you, like, you know, you made those resolutions. How are you on track? How is that going? What can we do to maybe get you back on track? And that's kind of the idea with this program as well.
From July 11th to 12th, activists from the Immigrant Workers Center co-organized an anti-racist soccer tournament in the Montreal neighborhood of Hochelaga-Maisonneuve. The idea was to show that a different way of playing soccer, not FIFA's and not the World Cup's, was possible. Participants ranged from diehard activists to diehard soccer aficionados, and everywhere in between. CKUT's Carla Green was there.
When Lucho got the idea to organize an anti-racist soccer tournament in Montreal, he knew there'd be a whole crew of activists who would want to take part, but that wasn't the point.
We don't want to organize a tournament just for activists because it's useless, because people are already politicized. We want that people come. Of course, we don't want fascists here because they are already politicized. But common people who come here, we want this kind of people because we try to show them that FIFA is not the only possibility to have fun.
Lucho works with the Immigrant Worker Center, an organization with the mission of defending the rights of immigrants in their workplace. He's Italian, and the anti-racist tournament was inspired by a smattering of anti-racist and anti-fascist sports leagues across Europe, several of them with Italian roots. The Football Against Racism in Europe, or FAIR network, is probably the largest and most well-known. It's even endorsed by FIFA.
There are some anti-racist tournaments in Italy with FIFA as a sponsor, but our model is another kind of tournament organized by grassroots movement in Italy. For example, the Mediterranean anti-racist tournament is organized by autonomists, anarchists, communists, and all grassroots movement in Italy. So,
and not endorsed by FIFA.
No, absolutely.
The Montreal tournament was organized for the Friday evening and Saturday afternoon just before the FIFA World Cup final. The two events weren't unrelated. Here's Manuel Salamanca, one tournament participant who's originally from Bolivia.
Y ahora cuando tú entras, por ejemplo, a las redes sociales, puedes ver la exacerbación de las diferencias raciales provocadas por este afán de competencia que promueve la.
When you go on social media, you can see the racial divisions that FIFA is promoting. What we're trying to do here is to send a message that it's possible to play soccer in a different way. That winning doesn't mean that you're defending a particular nationality, that you want the Argentines to lose because Argentines are supposedly arrogant, that Bolivians want Argentines to lose because there's racism in Argentina, and you see Bolivian racism against Argentines jump to the surface. All these differences are exacerbated by the competitiveness encouraged by the capitalist market.
That's not to say that he doesn't watch, though.
Yo soy muy, muy apasionado. Mira, por ejemplo,
I'm really passionate about it. For example, look, I'm following and supporting Argentina because I live in Argentina. I like soccer because it reminds me of these things, of my friends. My friends and I talk about it. They're happy that I'm supporting Argentina. Friendships are made and strengthened. That's what soccer is really about.
Eso es la lógica, creo, del fútbol.
Lucho knows that not everyone who participated in the tournament came because it was anti-racist, and some participants might not have even really thought about what it meant. Early on in the tournament, he said, he heard some people making, quote, machist comments. Again, here's Lucho.
There are some activists who participate to this tournament, so they want that this tournament is political, but there are also many people who came here just for playing, and at the beginning was a little bit difficult because we heard some machist comment, for example, but we try to talk with the people, and then sometimes they say, oh, sorry, I didn't think about that, it's okay. So for us it's important.
On Saturday night at a local anarchist space, they did organize a documentary screening on the World Cup in Brazil and a communal dinner, both of which were supposed to be more overtly political than the tournament itself.
But for me, but I think for all of the organizers, even if just one people of not politicized men or girls come this night, for us it's a victory. So I hope that there will be many people who come tonight, even if the event is more political, but just for one people, it's okay. It's okay.
For CKUT News, I'm Carla Green.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. The National Campus and Community Radio Association represents 87 member stations across the country, including CKUT, advancing the role and increasing the effectiveness of campus and community radio stations in Canada. On July 14th, the association celebrated its 28th anniversary. Rachel Swatek, the NCRA's Groundwire coordinator, spoke with Pat Nagel, a founding board member of the NCRA, and Penny Clark, who is organizing a new monthly donor program for the organization to talk about the NCRA's roots and where it hopes to go.
I'm here with Pat Nagel, a founding board member of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, now the area manager for CBC North in Iqaluit. Welcome to Groundwire.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, we as an association formally started in 1986, and now we just celebrated our 28th anniversary. Can you tell me a little bit about where you were in campus and community radio as the association was getting off the ground?
Well, this particular current version of it actually came out of work that started many years before 1986. My involvement actually goes back to 1979 or thereabouts, when we first really started talking about getting this kind of a national organization going. And a lot of the stations were at a really kind of early fledgling stage. The first FM stations were really sort of getting on the air in 1975, 76, 78, 79, that kind of time. So people talked about it a lot those days, but we never actually got anything going. So as the early 80s came around, we decided that it would be a good idea to try and bring everybody together. So we actually held a national conference, first one in 1982 at Carleton University in Ottawa, and that's really kind of where the idea got going from.
Mm-hmm. So now, over the years, how have you witnessed the association change or impact the sector?
Well, I think the fact that you can call it a sector now is probably a good place to start. As I was saying earlier, it was really sort of a whole bunch of individual stations off doing their own thing. So the fact that that organization could help more stations grow and develop and could help people bring together their thinking around this idea of what campus community radio should be in Canada, how it should have a place in the broad spectrum of broadcasting, and how this was going to be an important way, like the community radio movement in Quebec certainly was, and some other things like Co-op Radio in Vancouver and a few other kind of isolated cases in other parts of the country, how this could be a way for a whole kind of volunteer segment or sector of broadcasting to develop.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or that I should have brought up?
It's hard to believe that it was all that many years ago that the whole thing came to being. But I think it's a testament really to, probably hundreds, maybe thousands of people that have been involved over the course of that time who've seen the value of what happens when you have kind of a volunteer community sector in the radio scheme of things across the country, and how valuable that has been, and how great it's been that all of those people have put all of that time and effort into it and continue to. I mean, it's the fact that a lot of these stations are vibrant, important parts of their communities, serving needs that aren't being served by other segments of the broadcasting business is really important.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, no problem. Thanks for calling.
I was just speaking with Pat Nagel, a founding board member of the NCRA. Now I'm here with Penny Clark, who is coordinating a brand new funding program to support the association. It's called the Friends of Community Radio Program. Penny, can you tell me a little bit about it?
So the Friends of Community Radio Program is a way for people in our community to directly support the activities of the NCRA. So that's like the National Campus and Community Radio Conference, programs like Resonating Reconciliation, resources like the Disability Handbook, Regulatory Support Guide, Earshot Online, basically all that stuff. It's a way for you to directly support those programs and what the NCRA does. How it works is when you register as a friend of community radio, you select an amount that you would like to donate per month.
So now you mentioned the NCRA has a number of different supports that it offers to its member stations. How are those things currently funded, and how will this fund make a difference for them?
Right now, our only funding that we have from the NCRA is through our membership dues that are paid by our member stations and through the grant applications that we make. So having a regular source of funding will really allow us to focus our energies on creating these resources instead of searching for funding for them. So it will really make a big difference to what we're able to do.
Now, where can people go to learn a little more about the program?
You can absolutely visit our website, www.ncra.ca, and you will see that Friends of Community Radio has a whole sidebar. If you want to hear more about it, you can absolutely send me an email. So just send me an email at Penny, P-E-N-N-Y, at ncra.ca, and I'll be happy to talk to you and tell you anything you need to know.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire. I'm Jaya Nizami. We thank Brenna Owen, Catherine Fisher, Tiffany Lam, Michael Freeman, Heidi Griffin, Sofsen Kadura, Catherine Garvin, Carla Green, Aaron Lakoff, and Rachel Swatek. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download this and past episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca.